Welcome to Court and Controversy. I'm Janine Yunus. On this program, I'll be discussing a wide variety of controversial topics with some of the most original thinkers of our time, and no holds barred. I bring a litigator's perspective, and my guests will come from different backgrounds and industries. Enjoy the show. My guests today are Jake Klein and Salome Sibone. They just got engaged, actually, so congratulations. very exciting. And they are co-founders of the Black Sheep website. Salome is a writer and artist, and Jake is media producer. And I'm here to talk with them mostly about Palestine and Israel, since that's sort of how we know each other, as sort of, you know, leaning towards anti-Zionist views. But we all come from very different backgrounds, so I thought it would be interesting to talk with them about how they arrived at their views and the things we agree on, the things we don't agree on, and all those related topics. So welcome, both of you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah.
So, Jake, can we start with you? And can you sort of tell us a little bit about your background, like where you were born, what kind of family you were born into,
yeah,
et cetera?
So we're in Washington, D.C. right now. I grew up probably not more than 30 minutes from here in Montgomery County, Maryland. I was raised Orthodox Jewish, modern Orthodox, so not the black hats, but right, still quite, you know, quite religious. And I went to, I was sent to a private school for almost my entire education, where Zionism was a core part of the curriculum. The school flew Israeli flags next to the American flag. Always, we celebrated Israeli holidays. We learned about the history of modern Israel as part of our curriculum. And our senior year, we spent our entire second semester traveling around Israel. So sort of like a birthright trip, but like much longer. And I was always sort of skeptical to the narratives that I was being taught on everything growing up, like everything under the sun. And that really started with my becoming an atheist when I was rather young and realizing that the religious narratives that I was being told weren't true. And, you know, you can totally be an atheist and a Zionist. You know, most of the founders of Israel were, but I just kind of entered that discussion also with a skepticism and just tried to question what I was being told. And, you know, without actually much contact with the Palestinian side of the argument, I just tried to think of, okay, like, what is the best argument I could make against what I'm being taught, just to like really try to like test it and, you know, figure out what I believed. And I sort of discovered over time that my doing that just naturally led me to the exact identical positions that I found, you know, actual Palestinian writers making later, because it's pretty clear and straightforward. And so then, you know, I think when I was in my junior year of high school, the Palestine Papers leaked, which was the negotiations between, on the Israeli side, Tzipi Livni, and on the Palestinian side, Saeb Erekat. And it was just these pages upon pages upon pages of transcripts of the negotiations. And I saw just how much the Palestinian side was willing to give up, you know, from what they were saying, even in public, that they needed, and how intransigent the Israeli side of the negotiations was, of just, you know, not being willing to budge on a single thing. And I mean, not a single thing, but very few things. And that was another really important, like, confirmatory moment of, okay, what they're telling me about who's responsible for the lack of peace here, I'm not being told the whole story.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And so then I've kind of gone from there.
So when you went, so you spent your senior year in Israel?
Second semester. Yes.
Oh, okay. And, did you go to any of the Palestinian areas?
I definitely went to like Arab towns in Israel proper. I don't think I didn't go like on a Palestinian tour of the West Bank or anything like that. I would have very much liked to. I mean, what my parents told me is like, if, you know, you go to one of these areas, like, you might get kidnapped or killed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know that's not true, but And I didn't really think that at the time, but nonetheless, yeah. You know, I'm on this tour you know, teachers that they weren't going to let me go. I mean, we probably did go to some areas that were like technically Area C because, you know, we went to the Dead Sea. So I guess that's in there.
Yeah.
But no, I did not visit Area A of the West Bank or meet with Palestinians in Palestine.
So you would say you came on your views gradually. It wasn't like an epiphany that took place.
No. Yeah. No, yeah, definitely not. But the Palestine, insofar as there was an epiphany, it was like the Palestine, reading the Palestine papers, but it was definitely a gradual process.
And has it caused you a lot of problems with your family? You don't have to.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, and listen, you know, she knows my family, obviously, because we're engaged. And I think you'll vouch. I have a great relationship with my family. I'm very close with my family. You know, we have many differences both on religion and politics. And, you know, I think I carry this with me as a person where there are many people that I disagree with extremely severely on, you know, core issues of like identity and deeply held beliefs. But I think I've been trained really well from having that upbringing where I was kind of always at odds with my community. This is true on the political side, too. We're both libertarians. And, you know, where I grew up, all center-left Democrats. Then I went to college where it was all far-left Democrats. Right. And, you know, I'm the only person who believes what I believe. And, you know, I'm just having to argue and exist in a society where I didn't know a single person who agreed with me about politics broadly, like another libertarian, until I was like 23. Yeah. So, you know, that really kind of trained me to, I think, like be a really good communicator and like get along really well with people that are just like totally opposite for me. So anyway, getting back to your question, like, yeah, I think I get along very well with my parents. It has strained my relationship with my family. It has strained my relationship with the community where, you know, where I grew up. And that's been difficult and that's been, unfortunate, but you know, I'm used to it.
Yeah. So Salome, how about you? Where did you grow up and what was your family like?
Yeah. So I was born in Miami. My family is Cuban American or my mom is Cuban. My dad was born in Miami. He's kind of just like broadly Nordic white American. And so I was raised there and my initial big change of mind was going from being a leftist to not being a leftist. Oh, wow. So I fell into the whole woke thing like way earlier than anyone else did. And that was a big thing for me because it taught me how to see when I'm wrong. And it taught me how to see how easily we take on ideas and become very clingy with them, despite them being wrong because of peer pressure or just like other influences that are not necessarily rational. And so
Do you mean you saw that because of how the people around you on the left were behaving?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically all the things that it's common for us to see in the left now, this kind of like tribalism, this lack of tolerance for dissent, these demonizing anybody that disagrees with you, those things, while I was in that community for a while, eventually I realized once I found out that these ideas are actually bad and have led to mass suffering, and I had that realization, I started to learn about group psychology and collectivism and individualism. And that gave me the framework to then analyze all these kind of movements, which is something I have now been applying to the right, as I see that same kind of collectivist tribal mindset rising, which is what led me to write the essay that I wrote for The Black Sheep, which is I changed my mind on Zionism thanks to both the irrational left and the right.
That was a great essay, actually, and that's how I came to know about Salome, because I had been in communication with Jake a little bit through Twitter, and he sent that essay. And one of the things that really impressed me about it was that you said that you purposely didn't take a public position because even though you had a sort of instinctual sympathy for the Zionist cause because, you know, they seem more Western and that kind of thing, you realized that once you took a public position, it was going to sort of be much more intractable, which I think a lot of people would benefit from. And I think in the sort of social media world where everyone feels like they need to have an opinion immediately all the time, that's actually a lot of what happened. I saw a number of my friends who didn't know much about the conflict at all and had those sort of, I don't really like Muslims, you know, they're mm-hmm. oppressive of women and gay people and whatever, took immediate public positions. And now I think they've kind of had to dig their heels in because they don't want to admit that maybe they got it wrong.
Yes.
So I thought that was really impressive insight and sort of unique. I hadn't seen anyone sort of put it into words that way, I guess.
Right. I thought that was the important part of my essay in some regard, because there are other anti-Zionists, and like Jake has been talking about this for a while, and he's way more informed and great at discussing the issue. And for me, I was like, what really stands out to me about my coming to this issue was that I was so wrong about it and I had to change my mind. And that was the lens that I wanted to analyze both the issue from and then the process of changing my mind. Because I know that for a lot of people, you just come out with this issue of like, okay, well, here's my stance now. And they just assume, okay, well, you're them.
Yeah.
You're the other side.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, no, I'm actually on your side and I changed my mind.
Yeah.
And you need to contend with what that means. Because yeah. Now we constantly get this where people just say, you're a leftist. I'm like, I am a libertarian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leftists do not like me.
Yeah.
They fight with me too, just like you are fighting with me. So nope, they don't want me either. But that's kind of this desire to just simplify things where if you're not with us, you're against
yeah.
us. And if you're against us, you're the other tribe. And so in that essay, I really wanted to bring home the process of changing my mind and realizing how easy it is for us to get entrenched in our opinions on an issue, particularly this issue.
Yeah.
I think that there has been a very strange collective psychology process going on that I have found it difficult to even put my finger on, because it's very much in the same energy of pandemic collective madness, like it's BLM collective madness, where it's like you can feel that people are so on edge, so hostile. You know, I know that you've seen this where people are turning on their own friends, like people just kind of losing it over this issue, and people that aren't even directly involved.
Yeah.
You know, that's really a red flag for me. And so in that essay, I tried to describe how I came to this issue in the way that I think a lot of people have come to it, which is you saw this absolutely horrible tragedy on October 7th and you rightly feel outraged and disgusted and you want someone to blame and you want something that tells you, here's the good guy and here's the bad guy and here's how we make sense of this. And yeah, so I did not take a public position, but I did talk to you about it. And so he can vouch for, I had terrible opinions on this at first.
So wait, I have a few questions. Okay, how long had you guys actually been dating at that point? How long had you known each other, I should say?
Both questions. I think about 2 years we'd known each other. Dating depends how you define it. Maybe about a year.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's about
so,
right.
So, and it had it come up before or?
No, not really, right?
Yeah, I think I had kind of buried it too. So because I had gone through all of this in 2014 when there was a horrible bombardment of Gaza, and my best friend at the time was dating a really right-wing Israeli, and so we ended up falling out over it.
Oh,
like
wow.
We got in a horrible fight, and I'm kind of in the opposite position where I have to check myself, because you know, my family's Palestinian, or on my father's side is Palestinian, and I have, you know, was sort of raised with very strong views. My father felt you know, that he and his family had really been persecuted by the Israelis living in the West Bank under occupation. And so I have to always ask myself, like, would I have these views?
Right.
I want to make sure I'm not just being tribal, too.
Right.
But anyway.
It's very hard. And I think we all are tribal in a certain way, in the sense of, like, we attach to certain foundational ideas that we structure like further arguments and beliefs on top of.
Yeah.
We attach to those foundational ideas very often because the people that we trust, the people in our community, already have them and are advocating for them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once we've built ideas on top of foundational ideas, we experience cognitive dissonance if you need to, like, tear down. I wrote an essay where I sort of compare this to, like, building a skyscraper, right?
Yeah.
If you discover, like, an issue while you're still working on, like, the first story, man, that sucks. Okay,
yeah.
I gotta tear down, redo the foundation, right? But if you discover an issue in the foundation once you're already up to, like, the 30th story, I mean, you're just gonna do everything you can to figure out why you don't have to tear down this building. And I think that's how people act, and they've contorted themselves into just really, really bad positions where they're violating a lot of the principles that they'd previously held. But they just mentally, they just can't get themselves out of this because the cognitive dissonance is too much.
Yeah.
That's exactly why I discovered by accident that process of not taking a public position right away and then realizing that it gave me the freedom to think through things.
Yeah.
Because it was just natural to me to not take a public position on something I knew I did not know about.
Yeah.
I had never previously looked into the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah.
Like,
well, more people need to think that way.
There
are way too many people who have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah. And it's really, and they're very opinionated about it. And like, that's what I learned is that as soon as you take that public public position, someone comes and says, but you're wrong because of this, you start doing the process of defending your views. That's how you entrench them.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's so interesting about the discourse is that the people doing this, you know, they're overwhelmingly not people that have any ties to Israel.
Yeah.
On the other side, not people that have any ties to Palestine. But it's people that have just kind of attached to I'm on a side at like a deep foundational level, despite having no ties to like the conflict whatsoever. And we really have to have, I think, like a broad shift in how we think about how political discourse works and how people come to ideas. Because it's when you realize that like there's none of the traditional reasons for people to care about this topic as much as they do here in America, you come to the conclusion that people care about whatever the tribe cares about. Like it's a social psychology, not an individual psychology. And so they're not defending themselves, they're not defending their values, they're defending the ideas of the tribe.
Right.
And we need to start seeing it that way more so that we can kind of, I think once you're aware of your own psychology, it becomes a little bit easier to try to combat it with some individualism.
That's a good point. So I actually had twice I've had interesting experiences with that, because first I was sort of on the left, like Salome, although I was sort of a member of bad standing on the left because I had disagreed about certain like trans things. I think I had once dared to say, you know, trans women and women might not be exactly the same thing. and I had some issues with speech. There were like a lot of, when I was a public defender in New York, there were a lot of initiatives to like combat hate speech in the office and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, no, this is not a good idea. But so when COVID happened and I was sort of mostly on the left and I disagreed with government restrictions, I mean, I really struggled with it for a while because I'm like everyone else. I kind of want to fit in. I don't really like to have to disagree and ostracize myself from the community. But that's what happened. And then I found myself exactly on the opposite side of that when October 7th happened. And I actually tried to ignore it for a while because I had this sort of strong friendship with a lot of people in the COVID dissident community. And when I like opened my laptop and saw on October 7th what the reactions were, I mean, I knew people would be upset and horrified. And that's reasonable, obviously. And I mean, I agreed with them. But all, you know, the calls to like raise Gaza, kill them all, they're all animals. I was like, what? These are the people I know who I like think are rational. And I tried to, for a few months, I just ignored it because I was pretty pregnant too. So I had other things to worry about. I was like, I don't want to be dealing with this. And I wanted to focus on the baby. But eventually I just couldn't take it anymore. So I forgot where I was going with that.
Your story is very similar to mine, though.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is, I want to admit how bad my opinions were at first, because even though it's embarrassing to me, I want people to know that progression. So that was my opinion at first. Like, in response to October 7th, I was like, why is Israel tolerating people that are so violent right outside? This is so dangerous. Like, they need to go in there and do whatever they have to do.
Yeah.
And why was it that I thought like that in that moment? When I reflect back, it's because I had no other lens to understand the conflict from.
Yeah.
I knew Israel as like a proxy of Western society. I knew people from there, you know, like I knew people that lived there. And I didn't know anything about Palestine.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about Palestinians. I didn't know any Palestinians.
Yeah.
And it was very easy for me to just be like, Palestinians terrorism.
Yeah.
Because I don't have anything else, any other layers from which to kind of counterbalance. Well, like, yeah, some are terrorists. Yeah. But there are also some Americans that are terrorists, yeah. You know, like, but
don't you
I
think
know of these people. So I have that like complex view of them, unlike yeah. I did for Palestinians.
Yeah, exactly. Don't you think a lot of people saw like parallels to 9/11? It sort of evoked that kind of like, okay, this is 9/11 again.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
in Israel.
Yeah. And I mean, to a certain extent, it was, I suppose, but the underlying facts of the conflict are still fundamentally different.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't, Al-Qaeda responding to just Americans being in the Arab world. I want to be clear, and I know there's people that are really just kind of fed up with saying this, but like
we all condemn Hamas. October 7th.
No, but I actually think it's important to say because the people that demand you condemn that,
yeah.
I think that they really don't understand the perspective that reasonable people on our side are coming from. And so to help them understand it, you kind of do have to prove it to them.
Yeah.
And you do have to say the thing. But I condemn October 7th. It's horrible.
We all do.
Yeah, and it shouldn't. Nothing like that should happen.
I need to make my
Hamas is a bad organization that makes peace so much harder. You know, they want to revoke the Oslo Accords and the process that has happened towards peace. So that is all really, really bad. But the overall story of the conflict here is really different.
Yeah.
And not all Palestinians are Hamas. Most Palestinians are not Hamas. Mm-hmm. They won the election in 2006 with a plurality, not a majority. And the exit polling in that election showed that 79.5% wanted them to change their stance towards peace with Israel.
Wow. And that was 18 years ago. The average year age, I think, is like under 18.
Correct. Right? So I think more than half of Palestinians in the Strip were born after that election anyway. So they're literal children who can't be blamed for that. But even the ones old enough back then to have voted for that, that wasn't why Hamas came to power. Hamas came to power because of horrible corruption issues and the Palestinian Authority. That was the number one reason that people gave in the exit polling from that election for voting for Hamas. Mm-hmm. They did not want Hamas's stance towards peace with Israel. And that's very clear.
Right. And I mean, I care about Israel too, and I care about the safety of the people there. I genuinely do not believe that this makes what the war in Gaza is making Israel any safer. I think it makes the West much less safe. Mm-hmm. Now there are all of these people, all of these children who are going to grow up and lost all of their family members in this war. Of course they're going to hate Israel. Anybody would in that situation. So Hamas or whatever comes to replace it is going to have a lot of fresh recruitment.
It's a cycle of violence, and people really need to understand the concept of blowback, where, okay, I do something because you did something, but now it just gets so much worse. It escalates. There's a quote we read in our recent video where, we're going to talk about this, but, I did a major debate on this war, and so we did like a 5-hour breakdown of every single argument that the opposing side made. And so one of the things that comes up is this quote from General Stanley McChrystal, who was an important general in the Afghanistan war, about insurgent math, where you think you get rid of like two insurgents and you have two less insurgents, but no, that's not how insurgent math works, because the people that you killed, they have family members and friends who they didn't think that that person was bad or did a thing that they should have been killed for, or that so-called civilian may have actually even been innocent.
Yeah.
And well, now you've inspired even more people to join the insurgents. And, 10 minus 2 doesn't equal 8, it equals 20.
And we learned this lesson in real life in Afghanistan and Iraq. So
yeah. And this works on both sides, right? Like the Israeli population, and here in America, as I said, I have no idea why people care about what's happening halfway across the world so much here when they don't have ties to it. We both have ties to it, so it's different. But on that side too, you know, October 7th is radicalizing them and making them worse. We have to start going towards a de-escalation mm-hmm. process. And somebody has to start that de-escalation process. And Israel has the vast majority of the power. Right. So, you know, we should be calling on both sides. We should be calling on Hamas to be less violent, and we should be calling on Israel to be less violent, and we should be encouraging Fatah for what they're doing, yeah, which yeah. is not, you know, not being violent anymore.
Yeah.
This isn't going to break until somebody takes that step of understanding, like, yeah, we have an excuse to get worse because they killed our loved ones, but we're going to make the choice to not do that because we actually want things to get better.
Right. Instead. And so people keep saying too, I mean, I don't know if you guys agree with me on this, but if Hamas just put their arms down, then everything would be okay. That's not true. That's not true. I mean, especially this government right now, but some of the ones before it too, want more land, and they're continuing to take, you know, things were relatively peaceful, as actually my dad talked about in an interview in the 1970s. But then Israeli settlers came in and took more and more land. And of course, the Palestinians started to get upset because their land was being taken. And then this led to a cycle of violence. So the idea that, you know, Israel just wants peace, and especially this extremist government that, by the way, that cabinet contains two Kahanists, which is just shocking. Americans should really know this. These are sort of people who embrace an eradication of Arab ideology.
Yeah, let's be clear, you know, who one of those people is.
Ben-Gvir.
Yeah, one of those people is Itamar Ben-Gvir. This is a man who, until he became a politician and was forced to take it down for political purposes, hung on his wall a portrait of Baruch Goldstein, who was the Kahanist terrorist who just shot up, like, and killed, I think, 20 Muslims praying at the Cave of the Patriarchs, who were just doing absolutely nothing.
And this guy's in the Israel, like, I mean, the idea that only one side is embracing extremist terrorist ideology is insane.
Yeah, and they, you know, they keep saying, oh, you know, these people are marginal or whatever. Netanyahu explicitly helped Otzma Yehudit and the religious Zionist parties, Smotrich's party. He gave them the instruction of, look, you guys need to form a coalition so that you can get enough votes to actually get seats in parliament, and then I can bring you into the government because your getting seats will help me get a big enough coalition to get the majority. There were like four or five, I think, elections in like a short span of time before this because neither side could form like a stable coalition. And this is what he did to create what became a stable coalition, is he brought in the absolute worst terrorists, worst evil people that exist in Israel, and made them major representatives and major powers in the Israeli government. And Likud is Netanyahu's Likud. It's more than bad enough itself. I mean, the entire founding philosophy of that party is revisionist Zionism, which meant, you know, we don't want any revisions to the border of historic Israel. Back in the day, that meant they wanted all of Transjordan. So, and Smotrich got in trouble.
From the river to the sea,
No, they wanted from the river past the sea. So Smotrich actually got in trouble, I think, just a couple of years ago, because he gave a speech in front of that map of the original, like, revisionist Zionist map of Israel, which included all of Jordan. So Netanyahu had to apologize to the Jordanian government because of just how crazy some of these people are. But even Likud, I mean, it was in their founding charter that, you know, they want from the river to the sea. That same quote was there. And so these are not peaceful people that if the Palestinians just put their arms. Now, having said that, I encourage the Palestinians to put down their arms because I just think it's the right thing to do. And I think it does help us get towards peace. It does help put more international pressure on the Israeli government and will make it much
and
more
clear. And especially right now,
guys,
I think, because there is a huge international shift in sentiment, I think. So it could, but that I was not trying to imply that I think the Palestinians should embrace violence. I'm just saying the idea that if they just put their arms down, everything would be fine is completely ridiculous.
No, I agree with that fully. It's the exact opposite of true. Israel would use that as an opportunity to try to dispossess them of at least the West Bank. The Ben-Gvirs and Smotrichs, you know, they want Gaza too. And, you know, the Israeli war cabinet is falling apart right now because certain people that were in it do not want to try to reoccupy Gaza.
Right.
But Netanyahu, because he relies on the support of Ben-Gvir's and Smotrich's party, cannot say, you know, we're not going to continue to occupy Gaza.
Right.
And so, you know, this is just making the war last longer. It's providing no end solution, because Israelis are not going to agree on that, and the right wing is not going to back down on reoccupation.
Right. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, so I mean, typically I think it's people's general understanding is that the right is pro-Israel, the left is pro-Palestine. I think that's a little simplistic. And in terms of real in politics, both the Democrats and the Republicans are very supportive of Israel when it comes to actually voting on legislation and that kind of thing. But that said, there is sort of a broad truth to it, especially now. So I was wondering, since you guys both sort of identify as right-leaning libertarians, why do you think that the right has embraced sort of pro-Israel sentiment? And why, if you think that's wrong, why do you think that's wrong?
Well, I'll go first. I've watched a lot of people develop their positions in reaction to the left. And I find that very disconcerting because it's unprincipled. I, to this day, watch people whose most of their commentary on this issue is a reaction to the left. So there are leftist protesters that are waving a Hezbollah flag or saying things like death to Israel. That's how I characterize all of anti-Zionism, all of the arguments that criticize Israel. They're represented by this extreme person. And so that's who they focus on. And so because of that, they develop their position in response to that.
Right.
And I mean, I constantly have this where people now call me a leftist because I criticize Israel.
Yeah.
And to me, it's really odd because I think that the right is dropping the ball massively when it comes to protecting their own country, putting their country's interests first, and being critical of getting involved in foreign issues, foreign conflicts that can be a big drain on our own country's resources. You know, have lobbying groups like AIPAC that are threatening politicians like Massey for not wanting to spend billions of dollars to perpetuate conflicts in other countries.
Right.
That is normally something that at least the right wing sphere that I've been a part of, that's kind of more America first and learned the lessons of how foreign wars are not something that benefit our country, seem to be dropping the ball on. And I think it's because they've been caught up in this kind of tribal political energy where they've projected on this idea that to oppose the left's response to Israel is to uphold Western civilization. And you see this rhetoric a lot that like Israel is a bastion of Western values and Israel is a pluralistic democracy and we're saving a Western ally by defending Israel. And on the one hand, that's not even a good way to actually be an ally.
Right.
Because just blatant support, uncritical support is not actually doing anybody any favors. That's just an enabling thing. That's just, okay, whatever Israel wants, whatever's going on over there, we support it. That's uncritical. But on the other hand, it's also this kind of like proxy internal war by which they look at Israel as if it's a little America or a little Europe that they have to save from the bad terrorists, the out-group that's coming in and taking our way of life. And it's just not that.
Yeah.
And that's something that I learned. Because, of course, when you don't know about that conflict, you don't know about the cultures involved, you don't know about the history, you look at it from your perspective. And for me, that is an American who is largely involved in the culture war.
Yeah.
And so I just look and I see terrorism, Islam, bad, democracy, liberal values, good.
It reminded me a lot of how the left reacted to Trump. Like, well, and frankly, the left's embracing COVID restrictions, I think, in large part because they thought Trump didn't take COVID seriously. So they're like, well, Trump doesn't take this seriously, so it must be very, very serious, and we should shut the whole society down.
Yes.
Because everything Trump says, it's the exact opposite of. So I think it's a similar phenomenon.
I think this is kind of broadly right, that the right and the left are really just, more than they have actual beliefs, are just kind of political tribes that
react
to each other, and the discourse develops off of that. But if I were to try to give it like philosophical grounding, what the political right is broadly conceived is it's the side of politics that believes hierarchies are natural and not to be like overturned. But the question is, what kind of hierarchies?
Right.
And so there's different factions of the right. Mm-hmm. And so there's factions of the right that are very militaristic. And, you know, I think they say, well, Israel defeated these people in 1948 and 1967, and therefore it's theirs now because they won by strength, right? And I'm not that kind of right. I'm a libertarian.
Yeah.
I'm an anarcho-capitalist, right? So I'm the most radical type of libertarian. The type of hierarchies that I believe in are the hierarchies of success on the market. And I believe in individual sovereignty and individualism, in the property rights that evolve out of one's right to own oneself, and that property rights are sacred, and that whoever owns property by, you know, mixing their labor with land or trading it away voluntarily in a transaction, they own that thing. And whoever becomes more successful in that process, that's the natural hierarchy, and they deserve that thing. And whoever is less successful in that process, if that means they're poor, that doesn't mean that we give welfare or other things to solve that. And this is something that, you know, libertarians like Murray Rothbard, who's one of the most important foundational thinkers in libertarian thought, you know, are very, very clear on. This is a conflict that started with the dispossession of property of, you know, 750,000 Palestinians were expelled. Yeah. I don't know how many of them were property owners per se, expelled or fled in fear during the Nakba. And their land was stolen. Israel passed absentee property laws that then gave them the power to just reassign their land to Jewish owners. Golda Meir, one of Israel's prime ministers, lived in a house stolen from a Palestinian Christian. Mm-hmm. And this, to me, is just wildly against this view of property rights that is supposed to be foundational for my branch of the political right.
And classical liberalism.
Yeah.
Which is something many people defended during the COVID era, from BLM, from the left. The anti-woke movement was largely a response to the left transgressing against classical liberalism.
Yeah.
So that's really where I have also seen the massive just dropping of the ball, by which people think, well, actually, we don't always need to defend it. We don't always need to stick to our principles, but that's not how principles work.
So I really agree with what you're saying there. And, you know, the American right is not supposed to be like the European right. You know, the European right was the defense of monarchies and stuff like that. The American right was classical liberalism. You know, what conservatives are supposed to be conserving here now was classical liberalism, the ideas of our founders. And what was the ideas of our founders? It was based in John Locke's life, liberty, and property.
Yeah.
So the American right broadly really should be much better on this than they are. They should understand the property rights issues at play here, and that there's all these people that were dispossessed of this property. There was a United Nations resolution like immediately after the war that the refugees have to be allowed back. I think this was in 1949. They still to this day have not been allowed to do so. And listen, I don't think much of like international law per se, like, you know, as a libertarian. But if Israel is going to base its founding in a 1947 UN partition plan, then you can't just ignore everything that the UN does from there while continuing to cite that as the justification for your existence. So I've been very disappointed with the American right on this. I think you're broadly right that it is mostly just tribalism. That is why we are where we are now. This just kind of feeling of Israel being Western, this neocon-ish like national security, mm-hmm. this Cold War era, like, you know, they're our ally there and the neighboring states are Soviet allies. And so, you know, therefore, you know, we have to defend this thing because I think it's completely at odds with the founding principles of this country.
Right.
And the founding principles of libertarianism and American conservatism.
And when we talk about classical liberalism, I mean, the idea is that there are fundamental rights every person has, mm-hmm. you know, to life, liberty,
natural
and property.
Yeah.
And so people say things like, well, you know, in 1993, Arafat should have whatever. Well, why should some 15-year-old kid or 20-year-old kid living in the West Bank not have civil rights, which is what they don't have any rights. Like, that, to be clear, people in the West Bank and Gaza, they're different because Gaza's under siege and the West Bank's under occupation. But they don't have any rights. Israel can, you know, restrict your travel, and they do. They imprison Palestinians without any trial or even charges necessarily. They kill Palestinians with impunity, take their property. The idea that because...
And torture them,
yeah. And 30 years ago, Arafat didn't accept some deal, so therefore it's okay to deprive a Palestinian kid of his rights is completely anathema.
Collectivism.
And that's exactly what classical liberalism is supposed to be against. Mm-hmm. So I just don't understand how it's justifiable.
We have to view these people as individuals. And, you know, Zionists and pro-Israel people are so quick to say, you know, look, Israel mm-hmm. is a, you know, classically liberal democracy because it has 2 million Arabs that are treated, you know, broadly equally. And okay, well, if you can live in peace with those Arabs, you know, why can you not take as individuals all the people in the West Bank and Gaza who are not committing terrorism?
Well, because that would give them a demographic mm-hmm. problem.
Exactly. And so you answered the question, right, of why this is hypocritical. Yeah. But this is not classical liberal.
You cannot
behavior.
Have classical liberalism and an ethnostate.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the big fracturing right now in the right, is that there's people that want to associate with classical liberalism because they did that when they were pushing back on wokeness, but now they also want to be able to gain the benefits of collectivism and ethno-nationalism and say, well, in this case, we don't want to apply those principles. But that's not how principles work. And this has driven me crazy because the whole point of principles is that they work if you apply them.
And they're non-negotiable.
Exactly. They are always correct. That's what a principle is that it naturally follows it gets you that outcome.
Right.
If you protect free speech, you have free speech.
Right.
It's a principle.
Right.
And so if you abandon these principles, you don't get those outcomes. And naturally, like something like an ethno-nationalist ideology that necessarily tries to retain an ethnic majority is inherently going to create conflict. It depends on the creation and maintenance of an outgroup that is kept subordinate. That is the definition of conflict when you have an outgroup that is there. It's not just like they're alone and there's no one else there to subjugate. So I don't see how anybody can defend that and think that they're going to find some kind of peaceful situation when you have a people that all they're being left with is just accept the status quo, which is that you have less rights than other people.
So it's my perception, having lived through a couple of these sort of big blow-ups between Palestine and Israel, that there's sort of a change on the right this time. And I don't know if it has to do with the fact that this war is so much more egregious than some of the other circumstances, or if it's just a change in values on some factions of the right. But I was curious about your thoughts on that. You can either of you.
I think that it's interesting. So we went to Dissident Dialogues recently and you did the debate there. And I wrote an article about how that event allowed me to see these different fractures in the right.
You should explain what Dissident Dialogues was.
Okay, so it was a two-day event where there was a bunch of different talks and lectures, and the whole idea was to have this kind of like heterodox space within the right where we could debate ideas like, has liberalism failed? What is the future of feminism? Is the war that Israel is waging against Hamas a just war? Richard Dawkins and Ayaan Hirsi Ali discussing like Christianity and things like that.
It was basically a conference for like the anti-woke right to talk about the things that the anti-woke right talks about.
Right. And so there were these different factions within there. You know, there were people that were arguing this war is just.
Yeah.
And so you have that kind of like neocon direction in the right anti-woke space. So it's like that's one direction where you have people that literally want perpetual war. Someone like Eli Lake, who has supported every war he's ever written about. Like, it's crazy actually to look into it and realize, oh, this guy is a legitimate warmonger.
Yeah.
So that's one example of where we could go, right? In this whole right-wing anti-woke sphere, which you're right to break down these different factions in the right. It's not just the right.
Can I talk about Eli Lake for a second?
Please do. It's incredible.
Let me say who Eli Lake is. We are going to get to the debate.
Yeah. So okay. If we could just get to the debate now, do you want to do that?
Might as well.
Yeah, this is a good
question. Because it is helpful to understand these kind of like different factions in the right and like why they're
being weird on this issue. We can always come back to the central question if we want. But okay, so Jake took part in a debate a few weeks ago that got quite a bit of media. And I think the moderator, personally, I think the moderator was not in any way impartial and like not even anyone's imagination. So the debate, Jake did a great job, as did his, as did Brianna Joy Gray. I guess his opponents did a great job in that they probably managed to convince a lot of people through their lies that they were correct.
They didn't need to do much convincing. That whole audience was already on their side from the beginning.
I don't know that they did much convincing.
They didn't have to.
I wasn't entirely sure what the audience is, so maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. But anyway, it sort of blew up to an extent after. I'll let Jake.
There was like online fights between Constantine and Brianna that made it. But okay, so the other side was Eli Lake and Michael Moynihan.
Right.
So there's this guy, Eli Lake, who's a writer for Commentary Magazine, who is, you know, an arch neocon.
Regularly writing for the Free Press now, by the way.
Regularly writing for the Free Press and Bloomberg also, I think.
Maybe.
But so he's advocated, like Salome said, for like every war you can think of since the Iraq war. He wanted to invade Yemen and Somalia like at one point. Still, he's a person who in the current year says that invading Iraq was the right decision and mocks those who say that, like, oh, people who, you know, think that people who supported this should have to apologize, you know, are being ridiculous, right? Like, he's insulted and offended that he should have to apologize for making a mistake about the Iraq war. And this guy is somebody who just laughed out loud on stage at his opponents, who, you know, wants the Palestinians to just submit and take it, who hosted a denier of the Dariusine massacre on his podcast.
Even Dennis Prager doesn't deny.
Right.
I watched his debate where he was like, that was horrible.
Yeah.
No, but it was one event, so it's okay.
No realistic Israeli historian. I mean, there's fringe people that, you know, aren't taken seriously that argue that. But, you know, Benny Morris, you know, admits the Dariusine massacre happened, admits it was horrible, you know, all this stuff. This is mainstream history.
We should maybe briefly explain. It was a massacre that occurred in, was it 1948 exactly?
It was during the war. So, you know, the families were lined up and shot.
By the Zionists.
By the Zionists. Yeah, by the Irgun and Lehi militias. The leaders of those militias later would get elected prime ministers of Israel, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir. And, you know, the Palestinians were Palestinian civilians were captured and, you know, walked through the streets of Jerusalem and jeered at by Zionists and then killed. So very similar to what we saw, on October 7th or 8th, when, you know, we saw these videos of like trucks with, you know, passed out, you know, Israeli bodies being like spit on and stuff. Like, they did that same stuff in 1948. rapes occurred, all this sort of stuff. So hosted a denier of that massacre on his podcast and just wants the Palestinians to sit and accept, you know, whatever the Zionists force on them. That was his solution to the conflict at the end. And this is just such a lesson, I think, for like how cognitive dissonance can warp people, where like he just so can't get over the fact that he was wrong about the Iraq war and wrong about, you know, neoconservative foreign policy positions, that he is now just doubling down and doubling down and doubling down until it's warped him into this place where he will just justify the worst atrocities or deny the worst atrocities that have like ever occurred against human beings, that, you know, you can see what's happening, you know, on video to these people in Gaza. And it's just such a lesson of don't let this happen to you. Like on any political issue, like if you start to notice yourself going to a place where you're denying the humanity of people, where you're justifying like massacres and atrocities, like you've got to catch yourself and you've got to stop, because as human beings, we're just psychologically wired to defend our reputations. Mm-hmm. And if we go too far in that and we made mistakes that now we have to defend in order to defend our reputations, boy, this guy is an example of just how horrible that can get.
And then it turned out, did you want to say something?
You said it all, but I mean, I think one of the things I'd like to tack on to that I realized recently, it's that it's funny how simple some truths are, which is notice when you're being driven by hate.
Yeah.
Notice when you're being driven by retribution.
Yeah.
And it's so funny how we will just kind of rationalize that away and say like, oh, well, this is the rational thing to do is to be driven by hate. And it's like, well, then what kind of outcome do you think you're going to get?
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to have an oversized reaction, and then it comes back to that blowback, and then it's forever back and forth. And the hard part about this, and this is something that stood out to me in that debate, was that your side of the debate, the anti-war side, naturally focused on peace when offering, well, what would be your solution to the conflict? Right. Both of them said, well, for there to be peace, this needs to happen. And they literally used the word peace in their answers. Moynihan and Eli Lake did not use the word peace.
Yeah.
They did not even get near the idea of, for there to be peace, there needs to be, it was just, stop starting wars, you're going to lose.
Right, right.
And it's like, that's not peace.
I know. I mean, that's one of the ironic things is like, we get accused of being, you know, on the side of the bad guys when all we want is for the killing to stop. We're the ones who are saying, no, like this is not. And if Hamas was killing people right now, I mean, okay, there are issues with respect to the fact that one thing that's being protested is the fact that the U.S. government is the one who's funding a lot of this. Mm-hmm. So we have an ability to affect that in the way that we don't have the ability to affect Hamas. But that aside, if Hamas was killing people every day, I would be on Twitter condemning that too. But what's happening right now is the killing of Palestinians. So that's one reason, among others, that I am, you know, talking about that issue. I think it's really just crazy that they've been able to frame themselves as the good guys when we're the ones who are saying, just stop the killing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but that is just the classic kind of us versus them tribal mentality that it's, I read this quote the other day that was just incredible. I can't, it's too long to repeat verbatim, but essentially it is the idea of social identity theory, which is the identity we gain as individuals from association with groups. And it very much has to do with that kind of group psychology and tribalism, by which everything that the other side does is bad, is reprehensible, is an example of how they are less than human. Everything that our side does is noble. We have kinship for each other. We sacrifice for each other. It's the epitome of humanizing. Mm-hmm. And it's just this classic thing of when the savage other, the depraved other, and the noble us, and that when you catch yourself in that kind of mindset, that's a time to pause.
Yeah.
And there's so many instances of discussing this issue that just, to me, are big red flags. Like, we need to pause. Why are you broadly characterizing an entire group of people as evil? You know, as terrorists, things like this, that it's just, it doesn't help the discussion. It just furthers the tribalization, and which makes it intractable and leads to more conflict. You have people cheering for war.
Yeah, absolutely. So you also, well, first of all, I was curious why you agreed to do the debate, since the moderator was so biased.
Oh, that was a great opportunity for me. Yeah. I would never. I mean, we have, you know, a very small following. Yeah. That was people, you know,
I didn't mean it. I was more like, I was curious.
100 people, yeah. 100 times the following, yeah, of me, you know, on stage.
Yeah.
That was a great opportunity. I have no regrets about doing it. I think I did a very good job. I wish I'd been given.
You did do a very good job, but the moderator was awful. So
yeah, he cut in a lot of time. I still,
we weren't given any chances to do rebuttals on stage, like literally not once, which led to like people talking over each other and all that stuff. I had to beg him to let him read me, to have him let me read 2 sentences that directly contradicted the thing that the other people said. He just conducted a 4-person interview on stage and not a debate where we could actually like respond to the things that they said, where, you know, I understand how that audience is going to get further entrenched in their biases from hearing what the other side had to say if they're not given any opportunity to hear a rebuttal. And by the way, you know, I would want that from the other side towards me. Like, so we just released a over 5-hour response to, because, you know, weren't allowed any on stage, so figured why not take it to the absolute maximum afterwards, to every single time they spoke in the debate. You know, we give like our response, and some of these responses are like over a 30-minute long.
Wow.
So, like, to like a sentence that they said, to like really like unpack and like use this as an opportunity to like educate about the conflict. And, you know, I'm really encouraging in this response video of, you know, like, I don't know everything. You don't know everything. We want to make this like a learning experience. If there's something you don't know, like, put it down in the comments. Like, you know, this is a conflict that's been going on for 70 years. I mean, really longer, really more than a century because of the British Mandate period. And historians have been going back and forth. Journalists have been going back and forth debating. This is incredibly complicated. And all these people that want to think like it's simple and easy, it's not simple and easy. And it's good for people to understand the nuances and complexity. So I think it's a shame we weren't allowed that rebuttal time on stage. And I'm glad we've gotten to release this video afterwards where we can do that with people. But this was a great opportunity for me. I'm really glad that I did. I was asked only 3 days before to replace somebody who dropped out. So to have any ability to educate and help people understand, I'll go into hostile.
It's brave. It's brave of you. I don't blame you. I probably would have said no. What's been the reaction to the video that you released?
Mixed. There's been a lot of people that really, really appreciate it. And even, you know, actually after the debate, even though the audience was so hostile, you know, we stayed for the second day of the conference. We were going anyway before I got asked to speak, because I got asked because I'm friends with the organizer and friends with a lot of people that were going. So, you know, the next day and the night afterwards, many, many people came up to us and said, hey, you know, I don't totally agree with you, but I'm really glad that you came here and represented this position. And, you know, I learned more, and, you know, I think it's more complicated now than I did going in. And that was exactly my goal. That's all. I didn't set out to change anybody's mind. I just set out to say it's not as simple as the talking points that you hear, and like understand a little bit more. So I'd say with this response video so far, we're getting kind of a similar response from people, which I am really encouraged by and really happy to see. But there's also been some that have just name calling, rude. And, you know, this is despite, you know, as I said, I explicitly said, like, hey, you disagree with me. You think there's context I didn't provide. Like, leave it down in the comments. And a couple people have done that. But more than they've done that, we've gotten people that have just ignored my instructions to, you know, just put it down in the comments, but be respectful. And have just been
absolutely not respectful.
Yeah, absolutely deranged and attacking us and making it personal and all this sort of stuff that is just completely unnecessary and doesn't help people understand what's going on.
Yeah, and it's really just glaring, because a lot of these people, I'm sure, take issue with the left being that same way, where it's just name calling and it's just a hostility, and yet they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And so that very much to me is a sign of someone that should not be discussing the issue. I'm becoming very, very tired. Okay? I'm very tired because I find that the attitude most people take to this issue is just reprehensible.
Yeah.
Because I understand that you're upset. I understand that you're afraid. I understand that you want to see good prevail, but you are not helping.
Yeah.
When you just add insults and you're unwilling to actually use reason and logic to find common ground or understanding, it's just not how you talk about serious issues.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that I saw in much of the audience in the debate was just this kind of like sports match energy. People yeah, clapping when it was like, oh, the many people in the Gaza Ministry of Health have died. And so they're not able to keep up with the numbers or whatever. Clapping. For what is that? What is that? At what point do you not catch yourself and say, what energy am I in?
Yeah.
Why am I cheering for dead people who are not actually terrorists? Like those people are usually medics.
Yeah.
Like they're just working a job at a health organization. And so I see this lowest common denominator feature by which people bring this discourse on this issue down, and they use it, right? Like they use it as a vehicle for their own emotional frustration and to kind of just lash out at people. And I wish we could get to a better cultural norm where we look at that activity and say, you don't actually care about this issue. You are doing this in a self-serving mechanism by which you're just using this issue to dominate the other side and to kind of like let out this antagonistic energy. It's so unproductive, and it really just obscures the key points in the issue, which is what you did such a good job with the response video, keeping it focused on the facts, focused on the actual discussion at hand, rather than just mischaracterizing your opponents or warping their talking points.
Yeah. Well, they'll do that forever. That's that's part of the strategy. Mm-hmm. So as everyone probably knows, there was an attempt to, I guess you would say a successful attempt to rescue four of the hostages in Gaza, but it involved the killing of about 274 Palestinians, I believe. So I actually didn't tweet about that because I was just like, I don't right now have the ability to deal with what people are going to say on this topic. But somebody that I know and had respected previously as a lawyer tweeted, he absolutely was not only accepted the 274 deaths in to save the four people, but he was celebrating it because he's Old Testament. So that's the kind of mentality we're dealing with.
I think that issue was complicated because I understand from the perspective of the Israeli state, their job is to protect their citizens.
Yeah.
And so if they actually rescued hostages, I understand how in that specific instance, it could be seen as a legitimate military goal to kill civilians in the way of doing that. However, what I really don't understand is why from the perspective of America, you're more interested in the Israeli civilians living than the Palestinian civilians.
Because we've made clear where our alliances are.
Like, we should be, exactly. But from just citizens like living here, why so many people think that an Israeli life is worth more than a Palestinian life if they're a civilian, if they're an innocent? It's just horrifying that is the case. So I understand the Israeli state's action. I don't understand the reaction here. And where I don't understand the Israeli state's action is the broader war. Like, this is one action where they actually, you know, saved hostages. But the overall military effort has involved the death of hostages, has involved the Hannibal Directive, where they're willing to shoot at their own people in order to prevent them from getting taken hostage, and has just avoided peace. In my view, I guess there's people that would disagree with this, but has avoided peace because they prefer territorial maximalism to the Jewish lives, frankly, like, because many, many more lives would be saved through peace than through this endless conflict.
So we should clarify that point, because this is something that people have a lot of trouble with, and we it's a good opportunity to find some common ground with people that disagree with us, is that we actually do care about Jewish lives.
Yeah.
We actually do care about Israel being safe,
yeah,
and the people in it being safe. And that is why we criticize this ideology that pushes a conflict to maintain an ethnostate, to maintain that majority, and to maintain land. This is, yeah, a land. That's a land dispute. Like that revisionist Zionist ideology in particular.
Can I go further than that,
go
actually?
Go further.
It's not just that I care about Jewish lives, in fact. I care about IDF lives, mm-hmm, and I care about Hamas lives.
Yeah.
Now, it's different in that the civilians did nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, soldiers we expect to die in war, civilians we're supposed to protect. But, you know, there's people that I went to school with that, mm-hmm, you know, after we graduated, even though some of them were Americans and not Israeli citizens at the time, went and joined the IDF.
Right.
I'm not going to say names, but there's somebody that I know in high school. Their brother died at the beginning, yeah, of this war, from a Hezbollah rocket.
Wow. Wow.
Okay. I was serving in the IDF. That person was half Israeli,
oh, wow,
or full Israeli, I think, but was living in the United States, but decided to go back and serve their, you know, mandatory military service. Now, soldiers die in war. I understand how that is. But at the same time, knowing the people that I grew up with and knowing how we were brainwashed into supporting this state and supporting, mm-hmm, the political ends of a country, you know, halfway across the world, despite the fact that, you know, we were all raised in America, like, that's how they became soldiers.
Well, also, you know? Israel has mandatory military service.
No, I know, so, but yeah. I think...
Well, you're talking about the Americans,
yeah,
I know.
I'm talking
but
about,
like,
the Americans, but yeah, also I don't even think that applied in their case. Also, yeah, conscription is evil. I mean,
yeah,
period,
yeah,
anywhere.
Yeah,
I'm,
no,
glad,
exactly,
we don't draft,
yeah,
here anymore. But so, just kind of knowing what leads people to be in that position.
Yeah.
And also on the Palestinian side, knowing how people can get radicalized by, you know, the deaths of their families, mm-hmm, and, you know, the oppression of countless decades. And, you know, I know that once they get to these places, deaths and war happen, but I'm so sad and devastated by the fact that people just kind of get to this place where they're willing to go and fight and die for these things that aren't worth fighting and dying,
yeah,
for. And I want to see that stop. And so, you know, it's hard. It's
I completely
hard.
Understand.
Yeah.
It's why I take so much issue with this collectivist rhetoric and this, like, now this fascination with kind of like nation building, rah, rah, rah. Like, we need to protect the nation. You know what protects the nation? Dead individuals.
Yeah.
It's using individuals, these Israelis that you care so much about, these Jewish lives that you care so much about, it's throwing them into battle as cannon fodder.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so old. This is so old. This is like, it used to be religion that people would say, that the leaders would say, we're going to fight this religious war for our gods. And it was never really that.
Yeah.
It was always to gain more territory or control the region or gain riches and things like this. It's not different.
Yeah, it's weird that Israel is almost like a religion and not like Judaism. I mean, it's
right,
like,
right,
a religion.
Oh, yeah, this,
oh,
is a big thing.
Oh, I can. We could do a whole hour on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I really think that Zionism is a secular instantiation of Jewish religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
yeah,
it was this idea that Jews from all across the world that kind of had,
mm-hmm,
you know, they shared a religion in common, but had different ethnic practices, different cultural practices, you know, whether they were in the Middle East or in Europe, or, and then which part of Europe, the Ashkenazi, mm-hmm, in the East versus, you know, the Sephardi that came from Spain and stuff like that. But it was this idea that we are all one people. We are all the descendants of Abraham, or this group that was expelled from Judea,
yeah,
by the Romans and have been in diaspora, and we are all coming back together as one people. That's a religious idea. That's a religious belief that's,
yeah,
not supported by the genetic data.
No.
I mean, or the historical data. First of all, conversions happened all across the world, and there's many communities that are really just like almost entirely genetically converts. There's,
yeah,
the Ethiopian Jews, right, which are, you can tell because they're black, you know, have totally different ethnic origins from, you know, Ashkenazi Jews. And then there's the Yemeni Jews. There was the Himyarite Kingdom of Yemen, which mass converted all of its citizens all at once. There's the Khazar Khanate in the Caucasus region, which is a little bit more controversial, but that's also believed to have been like a mass conversion. That one gets debated. But the Yemeni one does not get debated. Everybody recognizes that happened. And Yemeni Jews have little to no genetic ties to the rest of Jews, more so than any other genetic group. And so it's not true that this was all one people. Ashkenazi Jews have about 30% of their origin in Levantine DNA. They share more in common with Southern Italians than they do with Sephardi Jews. So this idea that it's kind of all one people, it comes from these religious ideas and the rise of nationalisms in the 1800s.
But there's also a weird conflict because Sheldon Richmond was talking about this. He had an interesting podcast with Tom Woods. But, because a lot of Jews are actually secular, so you don't really have the commonality of, you know, genetics. And you also don't necessarily have the commonality of religion. So it's a very weird situation.
But it's sort of like a secular version of certain religious ideas carrying on. Like, you know, Richard Dawkins has referred to himself as like a cultural Christian, right? And that's because, you know, a lot of what we have in the West evolved out of a Christian culture. And we carry on many of those ideas even if we're atheists. And I think you see that same thing happen in the Jewish community where, yes, there's enormous numbers of Jewish atheists and the founders of Israel were Jewish atheists, but they're carrying on more of the religion than they realize. And there's a lot about this idea that is just not taken for granted of the coherence of Jewish ethnic identity that comes from a religious place that people don't even realize comes from a religious place.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up, I think, but I could go on. I could go on for 5 more hours of this conversation if we didn't have other things to do. But thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. And congratulations again on your engagement.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.